Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this is a slightly unusual episode because some of it was recorded in the office, back when going into offices was still permitted, and some, like this bit, is being recorded from home. This is obviously a very unusual time, and we appreciate that every bit of news you will be reading or listening to at the moment will be about the biggest story of the day. Just like Private Eye itself, this podcast will be covering the coronavirus in due course and its extraordinary effects on the whole of our national life, but there are still other stories happening even at this time of national crisis, and this episode is on just one such topic. These stories mattered before, and they matter even in the middle of all this. And we hope that we will keep you informed on a range of such subjects throughout. To anyone who is concerned that the virus might affect our publishing schedule, we can assure you it will remain exactly as erratic and unpredictable as it always has done in the past. We make that our guarantee. So, with all that in mind, today we are looking at arguably an even less cheery subject, the tangled story of ICSA, the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse. The inquiry was set up by Theresa May in 2014 in the wake of revelations about Jimmy Savile, which were followed by claims of abuse about other powerful figures in the worlds of politics and the media stretching back for decades. Private Eye has been covering the inquiry, which is in the process of issuing reports into its findings, hasn't finished yet. One of the issues for news consumers is that while some of these allegations have been shown to be completely justified, others have been revealed to be fabrications. On a lot of occasions, the swirl of allegations has obscured the truth, especially when so many of these cases date back for several decades. Lots of different iHacks have been working on the coverage of the scandals and the crimes related to this inquiry. Adam McQueen and Jay McKenzie are two of them, and I spoke to them about the scandals like those in North Wales care homes, about the Eye's role in exposing paedophiles like Sir Peter Heyman, and the difficult but necessary methods required to separate truth from fiction. I started off by asking Adam exactly what prompted this inquiry.
It was prompted, as in fact was the entire inquiry, largely by the claims of a VI paedophile ring. Many of them, though not all of them, propagated by Carl Beach, who for a long time was only known anonymously as Nick. Who made all sorts of lurid and terrible accusations about things that had happened to him, named lots and lots of names of people who turned out to be entirely innocent and has subsequently been jailed for perverting the course of justice and child pornography offences of his own. But that was sort of the catalyst for this being set up. It's become the entire inquiry is just this enormous umbrella inquiry into all child sexual abuse in any context whatsoever.
Dating back quite a long way.
Dating back, yeah, into very historical offences. It's had to be broken down into various chunks. This is the Westminster chunk, which deals with the stuff that Nick, a.k.a. Carl Beach, said. Also various claims about other figures like Cyril Smith, Peter Heyman, the Elm Guest House in Barnes. Peter Heyman was a very high-ranking diplomat in the Foreign Office in the 60s and 70s. He had various postings in embassies overseas. And in 1980, when he was back working for the Foreign Office in this country, the Eye revealed that he had been found by police in possession of an awful lot of child pornography, basically. Okay. It was essentially letters which he'd been exchanging with other paedophiles. He was a member of the Paedophile Information Exchange, that notorious pressure group that existed at that point.
Yes, and for anyone who wasn't around in the 80s, this is a pretty eye-popping organisation.
It's an absolutely astonishing organisation. I mean, it was a 70s thing, really, rather than the 80s. Okay. It was an effort to sort of piggyback on the back of gay rights and women's lib and all sorts of things and claim that paedophiles should have rights too. And it gained an astonishing, looking back on it, seems like an astonishing amount of traction. The National Council for Civil Liberties, which at that point was headed by various people who ended up as New Labour MPs like Patricia Hewitt and Harriet Harman, actually took this quite seriously. It was affiliated with various different parts of the campaign for homosexual equality and things. Yeah. It was taken very seriously for a while, although not beyond about 1983 when it was disbanded and got rid of and regarded quite rightly as entirely beyond the pale.
Yeah. So, okay, we've got these are all the elements of the section of the inquiry.
Some of the elements. It's even more overarching than that, but maybe we stick to these ones.
Okay, so we've got Peter Heyman, mm-hmm. The Paedophile Information Exchange. We've got, you mentioned, is it Elm?
Elm Guest House. Elm Guest House. Do you want me to tell you about Elm Guest House?
Yes, please.
So Elm Guest House was a, as the name suggests, a guest house in Barnes. It was run and advertised specifically for gay men in the late 70s and early 80s. And it was the subject of a police raid in 1982, because of suspicions that child sex abuse was going on there. And many, many years later, it was brought up around the time of the furore and the immense amount of coverage of the claims of so-called Nick. It was sort of tied in with that. Zach Goldsmith, MP, stood up in the House of Commons. It's of course in his constituency down in Richmond Park, and made various claims that had been circulating on the internet for a long time about Elm Guest House and what had been going on there or hadn't been going on there.
Okay, so these are all instances where sometimes abuse has happened and sometimes it hasn't. And a lot of the coverage of the inquiry has said, this was all made up. Or some of it has focused on David Steele, which we talked to Francis about later. But a lot of the others have said, well, there was just no VIP paedophile ring. Is that a fair thing to say, or is it a bit more complicated?
The problem is it is a lot more complicated. And this is the problem with all stories of this nature, is that there tends to be truths within them and children that have been abused, but they then acquire all sorts of extra lurid details and rumours which circulate online and are kind of amplified, and they sort of metastasize into these enormous conspiracy theories. So the facts about Elm Guest House, as ICSA found out, are actually fairly straightforward. Yes, there was child abuse going on there. That was the reason the police raided the place in 1982. Criminal charges were brought against a couple of people. Lurid claims then got attached onto that all sorts of cabinet ministers and VIPs and almost anyone you cared to mention who's since been unmasked as a child abuser, including sort of Jimmy Savile, people like that, had been attending orgies at this guest house. In fact, the facts were pretty much as they had been exposed in 1982 was the conclusion.
So, this is the point I want to bring you in at, because you have been involved in covering the North Wales abuse story for The Eye, which was a case where abuse was going on. It was described in some of these similar terms. Tell us a bit more about that?
Well, a major investigation called Operation Palial, which was led by the National Crime Agency, has finally uncovered the extent of what was happening in the children's care homes and justice system within North Wales and Cheshire. There's still cases finishing up in the courts. In January, additional charges were added to the cases of two people who've already got huge numbers of convictions and are serving jail time already. There are people who've admitted to lots of the offences in these cases. There's no doubt that awful things were happening to young men and women who were living within the care system in that region, with a lot of people involved in the offences. It was sort of a coordinated set of men who were involved in carrying out these offences.
So this was a paedophile ring which yes, did exist, it was operational, and yes, has now been exposed.
Yes, that's right. So there were the people who were working at the care homes who were involved, and then there were young people who were living in care were being taken out to the houses of local, I'm not going to say VIPs, they were slightly important celebrities. There was a local radio presenter, there was an ex-professional wrestler, and these young people were being taken to them, ostensibly initially to clean their windows,
right,
and then sexual offences were being committed on them, yeah, on those occasions. So it was a sort of delivery service of young people.
It is interesting the way the coverage focuses on whether or not the people committing these offences were celebrities, with a huge amount more interest if they were famous, particularly if they were obviously members of Parliament, members of the House of Lords, all of this stuff. And this has been a real feature of the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse too. And it's obviously where a lot of the claims originally made by Carl Beach, a.k.a. Nick, gained their rocket fuel, if you like. It's why they were so widely reported.
I think within the North Wales case, the people being slightly famous or slightly important locally was a part of what made it very difficult for young people who were at the time 14, 15 and had no family behind them because they're living in care or, you know, very broken families behind them. And their sense that these people were locally important made it so difficult for them to come forward at the time that that then stuck with them, that it's part of the reason they didn't get justice in the first place was that these people were bigwigs, to them at least.
And it took a very long time for these North Wales and Cheshire cases to come to light, didn't it?
Very much so. So the people who've been giving evidence, whether it's sort of video evidence or actually, you know, turning up to court to tell their stories now, they're middle-aged, they've lived with this a really long time, and some of them had tried to come forward before. There have been collapsed cases. There was, of course, the libel trial that involved the North Wales investigation, where Private Eye and three other media organisations were sued for suggesting that there had been child abuse in North Wales children's homes.
The awful thing about an awful lot of child abuse cases is that certainly in cases like the ones in North Wales, I mean, Jane knows more about this than me, but I think I'm right in saying this, you know, this was a case of exploitative paedophiles specifically targeting very vulnerable children who already had all sorts of problems and whose problems only then multiplied as a result of the abuse. And there is confusion in victims' minds as to who exactly was involved in things, which can then be influenced by the sort of lurid conspiracies that do rounds. And I don't want to say this is just the internet. I mean, there was a magazine when the North Wales story first came up in the early 90s, and the I did a lot of reporting on it at that point. But there was another magazine called Scallywag, which was doing the rounds of Westminster at that point, which was the first one to sort of publicly name Lord McAlpine and various other Tory bigwigs of the time in association with that particular story. And then, of course, you jump forward to 2012, and that's when Newsnight, the BBC, get into terrible trouble because they have they publicly associate the name of Lord McAlpine with that scandal, which he wasn't in any way connected to whatsoever.
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that there are now names which are very much in the public sphere, and I think there's probably a lot of confusion if you ask the average person whether or not Lord McAlpine was guilty of any offence. I think it'd be pretty mixed. I don't think eventually being cleared or, you know, an apology and a retraction actually does rescue someone's name.
As indeed, Harvey Proctor and Lord Bramall and all of the other people who were associated with this by Carl Beach have discovered. It is absolutely appalling. But, I mean, another example of this is the name of Leon Britton, which certainly circulated in terms of the Elm Guest House and various other kind of conspiracy theories that have been doing the rounds for decades. And this is one that the Eye was onto way back in 1984. Our late colleague, Paul Foote, made it very clear then that what he was talking about, the cabinet minister scandal that had been mentioned sort of euphemistically in the News of the World. He made it very clear that these were rumours that were being spread about Leon Britton. No journalist had been able to find any evidence at all of the truth of them. What they had been able to find evidence of was that members of the security services who were unhappy about being overseen by Leon Britton as Home Secretary and certain cuts he was making to budgets and various other operational decisions were pushing these rumours about him, and that was how they had ended up out there in the public sphere in the first place.
You also mentioned, we were talking about what we wanted to chat about today, you also mentioned the name of Greville Jenner.
Yeah, Greville Jenner is another example. I mean, Greville Jenner is now dead, but his children have been very quick to kind of claim that all of the accusations of child abuse that were levelled at him were also associated with Nick, with Carl Beach. In fact,
now, can you briefly say who Greville Jenner was?
Greville Jenner was a Labour peer. He was an MP before that, an MP in Leicestershire. It was actually way back in 1991 that he was first associated with claims of abuse, again in children's homes local to his constituency. A guy called Frank Breck, who was a social worker overseeing care homes, went to prison and made accusations at trial against Greville Jenner. You sort of have to pick your way through these things, because, I mean, the fact is that he was lumped in with Carl Beach in the names of supposed abusers, along with sort of Jimmy Savile and sort of almost anyone that Carl Beach could come up with a name for.
Yeah.
In fact, although they've sort of become associated with that in the public's mind now, the searches on Greville Janner's home happened in a full year before anyone had heard of Carl Beege, a.k.a. Nick, at all. And the Crown Prosecution Service did actually bring 22 child sex abuse charges against Lord Janner. The trial never took place because he died before it could. But a review into historical decisions that had been made over Lord Janner concluded there had twice been a realistic prospect of convicting him on charges of indecent assault and buggery between 1991 and 2007, and prosecutors had failed to follow that up. And that police had failed to supply details of further allegations to the CPS, as they should have done on another occasion. And that kind of story is one that comes up again and again in this latest report from the inquiry, that there wasn't necessarily a coordinated cover-up, but there was a general unwillingness to pursue things against figures who had political clout, who had a reputation in society historically. That was certainly the case with Peter Heyman, where two of the accomplices, the people who'd been sending this horrendous child pornography back and forth between them and Heyman, were both prosecuted.
Right.
One of them was a bus inspector. I can't remember. The other one had a fairly sort of everyday job. And yeah, the person who was extremely high up, diplomat in the Foreign Office, there was no question of prosecuting as well. Same thing with Cyril Smith.
So, in a similar way, in the Gordon Anglesey trial, Gordon Anglesey was a police superintendent in North Wales. At the time he was an inspector in the 1980s, he was part of this North Wales paedophile ring. One of the things that came out during the trial was that one of his victims had talked to two other police officers, given them a very clear description of a man called Gordon, and it couldn't have been. I mean, he had a very distinctive birthmark, so he described him exactly, but he hadn't said, your boss, your superintendent, but he described him so clearly they couldn't have mistaken, and they took it nowhere whatsoever. So there was no escalation of that upwards. It was simply dropped. It was a young offender making an allegation that described a senior police officer. It just wasn't pursued.
Is it perhaps fair to say that this idea of a really highly orchestrated and organised, you know, ring of sexual abusers and a really organised cover-up might not be the case, but that there were lots of kind of ad hoc attempts to cover up, slightly forget about things, pull the rug over them, you know, not to quite see what was clear if you were really open to it.
The young people who were the victims were very clearly chosen because they were easily dismissed, and they were dismissed again and again by people who things were disclosed to, because, well, they would say that they're a young burglar who blah blah blah, and he's a terribly well thought of member of all sorts of local kind of organisations, and obviously they're lying, he's not.
These stories date back decades in some cases, and there is such a confusing web of information for members of the public who consume news to try and work out, oh, was he convicted? Was he let off? Was he named by Nick? Was he not named by Nick, but actually his people close to him have kind of said, oh, this is all part of the Nick thing, it's all fantasy. How should news consumers approach this stuff?
I think in an ideal world, they should be able to rely on good journalism. And I think that was one of the failures of certainly of the Nick coverage, in that a lot of it was led by a very bizarre little online outfit called Exaro, who were far too credulous about a lot of the claims that were there and didn't bother to put them to the most sort of basic journalistic tests, as was then exposed by Panorama. And yet there was a story about Nick's school friend who had supposedly been deliberately run over as a punishment for trying to blow the whistle on this paedophile ring. And Panorama, doing the most very basic of journalistic checks, were able to establish that no one of that name that had been in the same class as Carl Beege had been killed at all, and that no road accidents fitting that description had happened where he said they had happened, you know, so sort of a year of either side of when he said they'd happened. So it's a case of... I mean, this came up with the police as well. The sort of mantra became that you believe the victim from the outset rather than treat the accuser with respect, but also test the evidence, which is what you have to do in any case of investigating crime or in journalism as well. And so that became a difficulty. And in that sort of hothouse atmosphere, I mean, do you remember that bizarre incident where David Cameron was interviewed on This Morning and Philip Schofield waved a piece of paper at him and said, "These are all the things I've been able to find out about Lord McAlpine on the internet."
Yeah.
Well, that is not journalism. I mean, that should not be happening.
The list of names he passed him.
Yeah, it was just he presented it as such. He said, "This is what I managed to sort of cobble together after 5 minutes on the internet." Well, you really can find almost anything within 5 minutes on the internet. The problem with this is that there is no hard and fast rule on this. I mean, in some cases, these claims of paedophile rings and VIPs in inverted commas at whatever status in whatever part of the country that is. Are true. In some cases, they are partially true, and probably in an awful lot of cases, it's like that. And you just have to take each one as it comes. I mean, I almost said the pleasing thing about the Exeter report. It's not pleasing. There's not an iota of pleasure to be taken anywhere in any of these stories. But quite satisfying thing was not only highlighted a couple of cases where Private Eye had been absolutely right at the outset, which was Cyril Smith and Peter Heyman, but it also confirmed that we'd been quite right about the way that we treated the Nick stories and that latest furore from about 2014 onwards to be sceptical about those particular claims.
Yes. So, notably, in the North Wales case, the National Crime Agency have interviewed hundreds of people there who are in the children's homes. And I sat through a 7-week trial in court, and the degree to which they'd carefully taken apart people's evidence and made sure that sort of the dates that they served time at various young offender programs and things were all the dates they'd said they were, and they got other people who'd been there to corroborate descriptions of even the pea kit they were wearing on the day to make sure that people's memories of things were accurate. They'd really, you know, gone into detail and investigated, and that was, you know, merited by what they found. But not every person who told them a story was telling them the truth.
Just one last very quick thing on the Exaro thing. It feels as though, because a news agency was reporting these claims, that was almost the initial point of contact for other journalists. Is there a sense in which other journalists might have thought, "Oh, well, these journalists have let this through and have given it some credence, therefore we will give it a bit more"?
I think there was, and there was certainly a great, I mean, there should always be protection of your sources as a journalist, but there was almost jealous sheltering. I think Exaro were selling things on to papers like the Sunday Mirror. I went to an awful lot of different news outlets, in fact, and I think that those outlets were forced to take things on trust that might have gone against their better instincts or their news editors' better instincts. But the nature of the story is that you are dealing with very vulnerable people, so that was probably a bit understandable under those circumstances. I mean, for goodness sake, I mean, Carl Beach ended up being accompanied to one of his first police interviews by a journalist from Exaro, so it wasn't just journalists that were making these mistakes.
Adam McQueen there, thanks to him and to Jane McKenzie. One other element of this tangled story that Private Eye has been covering is that of Cyril Smith, a Liberal and then Liberal Democrat MP who spent years abusing vulnerable teenage boys, and Lord Steele, the leader of the Liberal Party, who repeatedly failed to tackle the allegations years after he was informed about them. Francis Ween has been covering this matter for The Eye. I managed to have a phone conversation with him about not only Smith and Steele, but about several other matters relating to this kind of abuse scandal. Here's Francis.
Well, Cyril Smith, in 1979, the thing called Rochdale's Alternative Paper, run by two local college lecturers, ran a very solid, well-researched piece, and they had 7 sworn statements from young men who'd been victims of Cyril Smith at a local boys' hostel in Rochdale, the Cambridge House Hostel, which he'd helped to found, and he was secretary of the committee that ran the hostel. And in that capacity, and as a local councillor, he used to pop round there quite a bit, and would then spank these boys. He would usually find some excuse. He'd go into one of their rooms and say, "Oh, I hear you've been doing a bit of petty pilfering. Well, you've got a choice. Either I can punish you now and we'll say no more about it, or I'll have to go to the police and you'll be sent to jail, or I'll get you thrown out of the hostel. Now, which is it to be? Take your trousers down, bend over." And then, as several of them said, when he had finished spanking them, he would mop their buttocks with a sponge. And then the other thing he did was to cup their balls. He'd come in and say, right, I'm doing a medical inspection. Now, take your pants down. Let me feel your testicles. which, I mean, he wasn't actually a qualified doctor and wasn't a teacher or anything else. I mean, David Steele, the weird thing about all this is that one of the many reasons David Steele gave for not doing much about it was, he says, well, it was corporal punishment, which was legal at the time. But I don't think it was actually even in 79 legal, or in the 60s or the early 70s, legal to go into boys' hostels if you're a local councillor and spank people for the hell of it. But anyway, so Rochdale's Alternative, they published this issue, and they sent that. I got a copy at the time. They sent it out to all national papers and the local paper, the Rochdale Observer, and to Private Eye and to the New Statesman, where I was working at the time, just before the 1979 election, the one that brought Mrs. Thatcher into Number 10. And I remember reading it at the time and thinking, this is a very good story, and it looks pretty authentic. And then Private Eye, the next week, ran a long piece about it by Paul Foote, and I thought, oh, well, they've got in there first. And I was quite surprised. Nobody else picked up on it at all. There was just total silence. Because Paul Foote in Private Eye had outlined, he quoted some of these boys' statements and had explained that Smith was interviewed by Lancashire Police in, well, they investigated him in 69 and then interviewed him in 1970, just before he stood for Parliament for the first time for Rochdale. But that and they recommended prosecution, but that somewhere along the line, the DPP, the Director of Public Prosecution, decided not to, and the police sort of withdrew, were told to bury the file, basically. And so the Eye picked up on it, and there was total silence elsewhere. And I later discovered it was partly because Cyril Smith was putting it about that he was suing over this. And people were so terrified of libel law in those days, that was enough to frighten off most editors. And I then did a little thing in the New Statesman, because I thought it was so odd that nobody mentioned it. And I thought, well, perhaps if I refer to it as well, then they'll be emboldened. So I did a thing and mentioned, again, quoted some of these boys' statements about the spanking and the testicles and the rest of it. Yeah. And again, total silence. And then when he died in 2010... I did a little So Farewell then in the Eye, because there were so many tributes from Nick Clegg downwards about what a lovely, likeable man he was. Everyone liked Cyril Smith. And I just did a thing in the Eye saying, well, you wouldn't like him so much if you were one of these young men who were victims of his. And his brother, Norman Smith, then got very angry and gave interviews to the Manchester Evening News saying, Private Eye is a cowardly publication. They only say these things when he's dead. And I thought, well, no, actually, we said them back in 1979 when he was very much alive and he didn't sue or deny or do anything about it. And in fact, he far from denying it, David Steele, who was then the leader of the Liberal Party in 79, who is a lifelong reader of The Eye, as it happens, saw this and he thought, oh, my God. So he said to Cyril Smith, this piece in Private Eye, is it correct? And Smith said, yes, yep, it is. And David Steele said, oh, I see. Steele has wriggled ever since, trying to explain why it was that he didn't do anything about it. And he's had all these reasons. He said, oh, well, he didn't do anything illegal. Oh, and anyway, the police had investigated it, and if there'd been anything in it, he would have been prosecuted. Except that, by his own admission, he says Cyril Smith had confirmed it was all correct, so it was all true that he was doing this to these boys.
So Smith became an MP for the Liberal Party 2 years after being interviewed by the police, but he was a member, which Steele claimed he hadn't been.
Oh, yes, that's another of Steele's reasons. Is he says, well, at the time when he was doing these things, he wasn't a member of our party and wasn't a member of Parliament, so I had no locus. That's what Steele keeps saying. I had no locus or locus as party leader. Completely balmy. You know, if you're leader of a political party and one of your MPs is exposed in Private Eye for spanking boys, you don't think, well, he apparently did it 5 years ago, and at that time he wasn't an MP and wasn't a member of my party. I mean, this is complete nonsense. But anyway, that is how Steele thinks. Either he's too innocent for this world, or he's just after the event, desperately trying to think up new justifications for his total inaction, which is otherwise inexplicable.
And then, as you mentioned in the piece, so in 1988, so this is many years after Steele had been informed about it, he nominated Cyril Smith for a knighthood.
Yes, he did. Which, again, when he nominated him, you'd think, did he not think he ought to warn the Honours Scrutiny Committee that I am nominating him, but I ought to mention that you might care to look up this piece from Private Eye because he confirmed to me at the time it was true. But no, not a bit of it. And it is, Steele says it's just coincidence, but other people say not, that this happened at exactly the time when the Liberals and the Social Democratic Party were trying to negotiate their merger, David Owen's party and the David Steele party. And it was all rather acrimonious. And some Liberals didn't want it to go through. Cyril Smith, in particular, hated the SDP and wanted the Liberals to be separate from them. And so there are some Liberals who believe that this was done to soften up Cyril Smith, that, oh, give him a knighthood and then he'll be more amenable. David Steele, well, he says it's not true, but he doesn't explain why in that case he did nominate him for a knighthood. Except he just says, oh, well, you know, everyone gets a knighthood sooner or later. But I think there are certain exceptions, one of them being this man who had abused boys who were effectively in his care since he was secretary of the committee that ran this hostel.
Well, and the other response from Steele, which you mention, is really extraordinary, because a lawyer for the independent inquiry on child sexual abuse said, did you think you should have warned the Honours Committee, basically? And Steele said it never occurred to him because it was all, in a sense, in the public domain through Private Eye.
Yes.
So he's given you the credit, at least, for getting this story out there.
He always gives us the credit. Yes, there's one of the most bizarre things about this is that every time I've written about it in the Eye, or almost every time, we get a letter to the editor, a rather plaintive letter from David Steele, yet again trying to justify himself. And he quite often pays tribute to the Eye and says, oh, I'm an enormous fan of your mighty organ and things. Even after all these years, he appears to be still subscribing and paying us compliments. But he pays us such a compliment that it's not the sort of compliment one would want, saying, oh, well, I, as Liberal leader, didn't have to do anything about it because it was all in public domain, so why should I tell the Honours Scrutiny Committee, or why should I worry because Private Eye has done my job for me and I don't need to follow it up.
This is one of the cases where someone alleged to be, quote-unquote, a VIP paedophile was abusing children in their care.
Yes.
There have been plenty of other cases where that wasn't the case, and there have been plenty more cases where it was. Do you have a kind of internal barometer or a sense of how to go about investigating these things and what steps are necessary when allegations like these come to light?
Well, the main step that is necessary is to investigate these things, which some people seem to think can be dispensed with. I think Jimmy Savile has a lot to answer for, because until the Savile scandal, I think it is true that most journalists and editors certainly tended to be a bit sort of shoulder-shrugging about VIP paedophiles or celebrity paedophiles. And so they were left alone and got away with it for a long time. And occasionally cases would arise, such as Sir Peter Heyman, who, rather bizarrely, I also used to know, because he was my uncle's best friend. It is a bit odd. One of my old teachers from the 1960s was recently jailed for sexually abusing me and other boys at my school. I do think I appear to be sort of accidentally blundering into almost every paedophile scandal of... I don't think I ever met Jimmy Savile, thank God. But Peter Heyman, I mean, that did come out, and that is in this new IICSA report. He was a very senior former diplomat, and he was also a spectacularly obsessive paedophile. I mean, extraordinary how many photos he collected and all the rest of it, and how many boys he was apparently abusing. But he was exposed by a Tory MP called Geoffrey Dickens, a rather larger-than-life Dickensian figure, who was justly very indignant about the fact that Heyman had got off when other people, Tom O'Carroll, the chairman of the Paedophile Information Exchange, and other defendants were being prosecuted. Heyman was not prosecuted. He was left alone, and he wasn't even allowed to be named during the case. So whenever witnesses were talking about him, the judge ordered them to call him Mr. Henderson, I think, because he was a prominent public figure and shouldn't be exposed in this way. And Dickens thought, you know, it's one law for the posh diplomats and another for everyone else. So he just stood up in the House of Commons and named him, whereupon Heyman made it to the front cover of Private Eye because he'd already been in the Eye. And so, everyone knew that there must be some famous or prominent paedophiles, just because very occasionally a case like this would happen. But it didn't happen very often that it was exposed. Much more often it was just sort of mutterings. And everyone knew that paedophiles existed because there was a very famous TV documentary called Johnny Go Home in the 70s. The main figure in it was a man called Roger Gleaves, who styled himself as the Bishop of Medway. And he used to pick up runaway boys at Euston Station and do horrible things to them. And there was a whole sort of culture around the meat rack in Piccadilly Circus and the Playland games. But there's luckily there's a person called Adam McQueen who's just written an entire novel about this. So that's very evocative of that whole era and that whole milieu. And so in the case of Cyril Smith, for example, there were quite a lot of boys who were willing to give ex-boys sworn statements and all the rest of it. So I found that very convincing. If it's one lone and slightly flaky person who keeps changing his story, who says that, that the Duke of Edinburgh was a paedophile or the Pope was a paedophile or whoever it might be, you'd say to them, well, I need to be convinced. Is there any evidence at all? Well, he raped me at a party where he also murdered five other boys. This took place in broad daylight on Westminster Green. By and large, you would be fairly sceptical about that. You certainly wouldn't rush into print, as some people did. But I absolutely agree that there are paedophiles, and well-connected paedophiles. I mean, particularly my dad, because I was abused myself in the 1960s by one of my teachers, a man called Charles Napier. And because he happens to be the half-brother of John Whittingdale, the Tory MP, who was Mrs. Thatcher's parliamentary private secretary, Tom Watson got this idea into his head. He thought, ha-ha, Charles Napier, this prominent paedophile. I mean, he went on after he left my school in a hurry. He went on to become treasurer of the Paedophile Information Exchange. A slight clue, I suppose. But he carried on abusing. And it was only millions of years later, I mean, it was again in about 2012, I discovered that Napier was back in the country, having been living abroad for many years, not least because he was on the run. And I discovered he was down in Dorset living with his elderly mother and was putting on a literary festival which involved him giving talks in the local school at Sherburn. And I was a bit surprised, so at least I rang him up and I said, hello, Mr. Napier. My name is Francis Wheen. I'm a journalist from Private Eye. I don't know if you remember me from school back in the 1960s. And he groaned and said, oh, yes, I remember you. Mainly because I had been writing about him at regular intervals ever since. I mean, I never saw any reason not to, since I knew from my own experience and those of my fellow pupils that he certainly had abused us. In the 70s, 80s, 90s, I regularly, if I've had the opportunity, would mention I was abused by this man, Charles Napier. And nothing happens. And then suddenly I wrote a thing in the Eye about this festival he was organising where he was going into schools, even though he had by this stage been banned from every school in the country, supposedly, as a teacher. He said to him, and I said, aren't you banned from every school in the country? He said, only from teaching in schools. And I said, oh, I see. And I wrote this piece in the Eye, and then the police got on to me and launched an inquiry. And after about a year's tracking down everyone who'd been at my school, they found about 30% of the boys in the school had been sexually abused by him, and some of them very badly. I mean, one in particular tried several times to commit suicide afterwards, so it wasn't light stuff. I mean, I got off very lightly, but I think because he had friends in high places, that again added to the conspiracist idea that, oh, well, it must be. And so poor old John Whittingdale, completely blameless in the thing, has spent his entire life being embarrassed and annoyed by the behaviour of his brother, suddenly got dragged into this with all the nudge-nudge stuff from Tom Watson about number 10 Downing Street and a former Prime Minister, i.e. Thatcher.
But is that there is something slightly encouraging almost about the fact that banging on about the story, as you did, eventually worked.
Well, yeah, but it only worked, interestingly, after the whole thing erupted, after the Savile scandal, and after editors and police went from not taking these things seriously and turning a blind eye, went to the other extreme and started investigating absolutely everything, however absurd. I mean, the Ted Heath nonsense. It's only with hindsight I realise that I show a dangerous obsession with this subject. I think I probably ought to be investigated. Because quite apart from having been abused by Charles Napier, in the 70s, in about 1977, the Paedophile Information Exchange started getting into the news. And at that stage, it was not exactly respectable, but it was legal, and it was open. The man who ran it, Tom O'Carroll, had a day job as press officer at the Open University, of all things. And there'd be little stories about the paedophile information exchange and spokesman Tom O'Carroll. And I was trying to break into newspapers at the time. I mean, I'd worked for The Guardian already, and I was trying to freelance for other papers. And I spoke to someone from the Daily Telegraph, and because they'd run a story. And I said, would you like me to write a feature about these people? And they said, yeah. And so I just rang Tom O'Carroll at the Open University and said, hello, I want to know more about your organisation. Now, what is it exactly that you're demanding? Well, we ask for the age of consent to be lowered to 4. And just as I was reeling from the matter-of-fact way in which he said, lower the age of consent to 4, he said, so you see, it's not an extreme demand, because below the age of 4, parents will have the right to apply for an injunction if they think their child shouldn't have sex with an adult, and it'll then be up to the courts to decide if that... But it, really, after the age of 4, children should be able to decide for themselves if they want to go to bed with 50-year-old men. The way he said it just chilled the bone. It wasn't as if he realised this sounded really creepy and horrible and vile. He just said, so it's just a little legal adjustment, a bit of legal tidying up we're calling for. And at that point I thought, why is this man not in jail already? He certainly will be before long if he carries on like this, as indeed he was. In the trial where Sir Peter Heyman was not in the dock. And I remember my poor Uncle Charles, who was Peter Heyman's best friend, I think they might even have been at school together, he got a call the day before Geoffrey Dickens named him in the House of Commons. My Uncle Charles got a call from Sir Peter Heyman saying, Charles, I wonder if you could get in touch with my children, my grown-up children, as they were by then, and warn them that I'm about to be in the news, that tomorrow morning I'll be all over the television news and the newspapers. It's just I haven't got time because I've got to... My wife and I are going to have to make a dash for it. We've got to run to France and lie low for a while. And my uncle said, well, why? What's the matter, Peter? He said, well, I'm about to be named in the House of Commons as a paedophile. There we are. Could you just ring? I think his daughter lived in Canada at the time or something. He put the phone down. So my poor uncle then had to track down the Heyman children, wherever they were living at the time, say, I'm afraid your dad has just had to go into hiding because he's about to be named in Parliament as a paedophile. What's a paedophile? So the Ween family have done their bit, I think.
Francis Ween there. That's it for this episode of Page 94. Thank you very much indeed for listening. We do hope you found it interesting. If you want to find out more about any of the stories we've been discussing today, they are all in the magazine, which is available on newsstands. And of course, there are subscriptions available too at very reasonable rates. We'll be back again next month with another of these. We hope you tune in then. Goodbye.